So, the challenge today for Tom is to sync my prior delivery of this material to another group while I just sit here and lip sync. But if he doesn't do well at that, I'll actually have to deliver the material live. So welcome. I thought we could do today is just initially just sit for a bit, just to collect ourselves. And then, as you can see, I have a map that we're going to cover today, or at least a good part of it. And there'll be periods where I'll be presenting just some material for a short period of time, and then inviting a dialogue, because while I could speak all day about what's on here, I don't know if it's resonating with you or useful or if you're getting it or not. So I need the input from you to know where to go today, rather than me just going off on my trip. So there'll be lots of opportunities for questions and answers and dialogue. And then we'll take a break mid-morning and we'll come back, have another presentation material and more dialoguing. And then we'll break for lunch and we'll do the same thing in the afternoon. So how does that sound? Okay, good enough? You know? Like that. Okay. Just incidentally, when Mark invited me to consider coming again here, I asked for a suggestion or topic or something, and Mark said something about seven factors in practice, and I agreed, not knowing what I was going to do. And then later, this idea of presenting it through the lens of this kind of material came to me. But it wasn't really until about 4 o'clock this morning that I finally got the feeling of urgency to actually think about what I'm going to do today. So it's like, but I think I got an idea. So so thank you for the suggestion. It's there's a lot that could be said, of course, about the seven factors of awakening. And so I'm not going to try to say all that. I'm going to try to say what you can't find elsewhere on the internet. So whatever you can read on the internet, you're probably not going to get from me today. But other things, maybe. So does everyone have a map of the day?
If you didn't get one, that probably means you didn't sign in on a table which you can get during the break. And there's other information there, including mindful service jobs during the breaks that you might want to do to help take care of the center and make it nice and a friendly space for us today. Steve, would you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Steve.
Well, I can do it. There may be a few people who don't know who Steve is. So first of all, big welcome.
Thank you very much.
Steve, you had a wonderful talk last night, which will be up on the website for the show, thanks to Tom, so people who missed it can hear it. Steve will also be talking tomorrow morning. It probably will be crowded just tomorrow morning. And for those who don't know Steve, Steve and his partner, wife Kamala Masters, have been coming to the Twin Cities since 1994 to lead the annual Twin City Vipassana Collective Summer Retreat. And it's been a real support for many of the leaders and community members over the decades now, just as an annual time to dig deep into the practice with two very wonderful experienced teachers. And we've also had the good fortune to have Steve come. This is the second time to do additional teachings. Steve has done a lot of study and practice with the Abhidhamma, kind of the Buddhist psychology, and integrating that into our lay lives and how to find some real peace and happiness as lay people, busy lives, lots of responsibilities. So we're hoping that this can be more than just two times, but we'll see. Steve and Kamala have a wonderful vision for their land on Maui, and they've been working on that for over 10 years now to develop a retreat place for experienced practitioners and also a practice place for the Maui Dharma community. So they've been working on that, and Steve has been a real institution at IMS in Massachusetts, the kind of grandmother institution, places like Common Ground. And he's been started out as staff and on the board, and then one of the guiding or senior teachers there now for a while, including leading the 3-month retreat for many years. And finally, they gave you a break for a while. We'll see how long that lasts. So thanks, everybody, for coming. And any questions about nuts and bolts before we begin? Steve covered some of that for those who came in late. There is a schedule up at a few places around the center, and Steve will guide us through the day. This is not a formal retreat, so there is speaking during the retreat during breaks. Thanks again.
Great. So let's just sit for the rest of the day. And anything you don't understand by 4 o'clock, we'll pick it up. As you begin your sitting practice, I'd like to ask you to pay very close attention to what you actually do between now, when we're just starting, and in the first few minutes of the sitting. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but just pay attention so that you can tell me what you do later when I ask you. So the topic today is the seven factors of awakening, or seven factors of enlightenment. And as you no doubt have already heard, the Buddha was a great one for compiling lists of his teachings. There's the three factors and the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, the five spiritual faculties, the seven factors of enlightenment, the 52 mental factors, the 12 links of dependent origination, and the 29. It's endless. And actually, most of them can be used as a template or a lens for viewing your practice, or really monitoring your practice and using them as a way to kind of gauge how you're doing, or to give you some pointers as to how to do, where to do, when to do. And the seven factors is a particularly useful map or model of understanding practice. It's used more often when people's practice is quite mature. When there's quite a lot of equanimity and a lot of balance in the mind already, then the subtlety of the seven factors can be a really useful way of, or template or lens to view your practice experience through. But I think it can be equally useful even in the beginning of practice. And so I want to try to speak about the seven factors today as a form of, as a kind of diagnostic tool to use in your life, not just your formal practice of sitting on the cushion, but to use in your life to really monitor not just awareness, but just how you're relating to the experiences of your life. And then to use the seven factors as a way of recognizing where you have particular strength in your practice and where you have particular limitation or deficiency, you might say, or an imbalance in practice. And then to use the seven factors as a way of pointing to an area of your mind that you can enhance, really, or to draw out in practice more. So, I want to try to do that today. The seven factors are known, or the sutra on the seven factors is known as the healing sutra, because when one of the monks at the time of the Buddha was ill, the Buddha asked one of his senior monks, might have been Sariputra, I don't recall right now, to go to that other monk who was ill and to give him a talk on the seven factors of awakening. So that when he did that, the monk, listening to the talk, recognized the seven qualities or seven activities of mind that the seven factors refers to, and in doing so, was able to recognize deficiency and overabundance in his mind, bring his mental factors into balance, and a balanced mind gives rise to healthy materiality, and thereby was cured, just by listening to and practicing the seven factors as he listened to the discourse. Even when the Buddha himself was ill one time, he asked to be taught the seven factors. He asked one of his monks to speak of the seven factors to him, during which time he also practiced the seven factors and also was relieved of his symptoms of distress or disease. So we don't need to take this too literally, and the quality of mind that the Buddha and our other enlightened or arahants at the time of him might have done, but still it's known as the Healing Sutra, and to the extent that we practice and cultivate these seven factors, we can also expect to at least we're doing the best we can with our mind to generate healthy conditions in the body. But we should be careful not to think that if I practice with these seven factors and I still get ill, I must not be doing it right. That would be a little too much to expect. But nevertheless, we shouldn't totally dismiss it either. Because it's pretty well documented, maybe from your own experience, and certainly it's becoming more confirmed by Western medical research that mindfulness, pure mindfulness awareness, has very powerful healing effect on the body and on physical ailments or physical conditions that we would call disease. Just very intense. This is not casual mindfulness. This is very intensive mindfulness, and sustained over periods of time, it can have a pretty profound effect. And there's lots of documentation available for that. So we shouldn't dismiss that out of hand, but take it with a grain of salt and check it out for ourselves, as the Buddha was always inviting people to do. To listen to the Dharma, and to understand it as best they could, to practice it, see for themselves. If it was useful, if it really was beneficial, then to have the courage and the integrity to live that way, and if it wasn't, to temporarily put it aside, or not to dismiss it out of hand, but just to say, not for me at this time. Put it aside. Later, there may be time. And I think that's an appropriate way to approach any of the spiritual teachings or the teachings of the Buddha, is that it may not be suitable for you at every time or at any time in your life, but at some point in your life and practice, it may be beneficial. So even what we cannot yet open to or cannot yet understand, and certainly a lot that we cannot yet confirm, doesn't mean that it's of no use or of no value or wrong. It just means not for me at this time. So I would like to ask you to do the same thing with what I say today. If what I say today resonates with you in your practice, in your experience, and you think it's helpful or find it helpful, then good, try it. See, confirm it for yourself. Don't just take my word for it. But on the other hand, if something I say kind of irks you, but if it kind of doesn't agree with you and you want to get kind of riled up about it, don't waste your time. Just let it go. Just let it go through like, not for me at this time. It may be right, it may be wrong, it may be useful, it may not. You know, that's really up to you. I'll be saying a lot, probably, and not all of it will be suitable for you at this time. Let it go. No. You don't have to kind of figure it out and jam yourself up trying to acquire information or knowledge which really isn't practical for you. That being said, the seven factors of awakening are indicative, or they point to the qualities present in a balanced mind. And I quite casually said that a balanced mind gives rise to healthy materiality. Well, think of it this way. You know, if one is a very angry or very anxious person in a kind of a chronic way, we know that being angry a lot of the time, or being anxious a lot of the time, or being depressed a lot of the time, has very profound physical consequences. The state of mind deeply conditions how the body is, and especially if it's over a sustained period of time. Well, imagine, on the other end of the spectrum, if the mind is in a very balanced, energetic and tranquil, alert and accommodating and kind of at ease with the way things are, and is very balanced in its relationship to the conditions of life as they unfold, and that's sustained over a substantial period of time, that the body is going to be also responsive and deeply conditioned by that state of mind. And physical, mental balance giving rise to the most helpful or healthy physical conditions that kind of support being healthy in our body, being energetic, not being stressed or anxious or disease prone. When I talk about the balance of mind that the seven factors cultivates or generates, when we look at the seven factors on this little chart, we see that the first one is mindfulness. Mindfulness, we all know what mindfulness is, kind of. But the subsequent three are three energizing factors: investigation, energy, and joy. And these are all qualities of mind that are very uplifting, very energizing, very engaging. And the final three, number 5, 6, and 7, are called the tranquilizing factors. And these are three qualities or three factors of mind: calm, concentration, and equanimity, that have a subduing effect on the mind. If either the energizing or the tranquilizing are out of balance, meaning one is excessive and the other is deficient, then we're going to end up with a very either over-anxious, overcharged, hyper-vigilant, hyper-active, anxiety-prone state of mind, or we end up with a lethargic, withdrawn, maybe dull, sleepy, soporific quality of mind, or lifestyle, you might say. And so we can see that if, in a general way, if, as you look at your own life, if you have a very high metabolism and are very prone to over-exuberant, energetic engagement with the experiences of your life, then you can find that on this map. And if you have a very, I guess we'd say, low or slow metabolism, physical and mental, and are very, not just calm, but you know, kind of on the downhill side of calm, then you can see that, oh, you can find that state of mind or that quality of lifestyle on this map also. It's not to make one or the other right or wrong. It's just to look at your life in a moment or over the course of the decades, and just to see and just to get a sense of how it is for you. And that's where mindfulness plays the significant part, because mindfulness is the truth teller, if you will. When mindfulness is aroused, it sees the present moment. And the other qualities of mind that arise with mindfulness allow us to recognize it and to be in a balanced relationship to it, not attached or averse or confused by it. And it is this honest connection and appraisal and acknowledgement of the present moment that will tell you without fail and without spin what your present moment's experience is. There's a quality of mind that arises with awareness or mindfulness. It's called ujjukata. I don't have it on this page, but it's another one of these factors of mind, one of the 52. And ujjukata is what's called straightness of mind. It's the mind's ability, with the aware mind's ability, to see things as they are without spin, Now, most of what we see in our life, we put a spin on. You know, it's like you watch the news, you watch some news event on TV, and they have the video there, and you see for yourself what's happening. Okay. But that's not enough. Soon after the video is over, the news commentators come on and tell you what you saw. They're putting their spin on it. They're putting their spin that this is good or bad, or, you know, this is useful or not useful, or this is right or wrong, or who's at fault. But actually, you saw the event for yourself. Why isn't that good enough? Well, mindfulness is the video, a camcorder of your mind, and the chatter of your mind is the spinner. And mindfulness cuts through the spin. Mindfulness cuts through the adding additional value to what the mind actually sees. So mindfulness is really the naked observer, if you will, or the naked observing, if you will. It's the ability of the mind to just register. This is the way it is. Like an impersonal camcorder. And in fact, if you look in your mind, or as you do your practice, you look in your mind, you'll see that the mind has been recording everything that you've seen, heard, felt, thought, believed, disbelieved, been afraid of, been excited by, throughout your whole life. And while you may not remember it right now, if you keep looking, everything that you've ever experienced is still in there. It's still in the archives of the mind. So we say, you know, the mind is like a sponge, very, very porous. It soaks up everything, even if we don't see it. Nevertheless, the mind is still taking it in through the sense doors and registering it. So often when we start or practice mindfulness with some continuity and some clarity, we discover stuff going on in our mind that we never saw before, that we never noticed. Or we discover how we actually felt in dramatic or challenging situations in the past that we just kind of skipped over, or that we've been hanging on to, or that we've been resisting, or we've been afraid of. And now when mindfulness gets some strength of mind and it sees things as they really are, or with a memory, sees things as they really were, no spin. The justification you used then, the rationalization that you used then to kind of allow you to do those sometimes unskillful, humiliating, shameful things, the story is no longer there. The rationalization no longer holds. And you see it as it really was, as it really is. This is the capacity of mindfulness. When we look at mindfulness and the proximate cause, the manifestation, the characteristic, and the function, it's an indication of how mindfulness arises, how it shows itself to us, what's it like, and what's it do. And the interesting thing, let me just back up. Remember what you did when I said, okay, we're going to sit and be mindful for a while. Pay attention to what you do as you enter into this period of being mindful. What do you do? Well, sometimes we sit a little straighter, sometimes we relax, sometimes we turn our attention to a particular object like the breath or hearing or something, or sometimes we give ourselves a little meditation. We do all kinds of things. There's all kinds of things that we do to kind of settle in and begin. But the one thing that all of that requires is that you remember to do it. Right? If you don't remember to do it, you won't do it, no matter what technique you're using. And so when we look at mindfulness, we see that its function is to not forget. And actually, that's all mindfulness does. It just doesn't forget. And what doesn't it forget? It doesn't forget this moment. It doesn't forget that this is it. In this moment, this is all there is. Just this. And it recognizes that this is life. This is the moment of life. And it flashes by in just a split second, and we have the opportunity in the next moment to either remember, this is it, or we forget. And if we forget, it's like we fall asleep. Because if we're not mindful of our experience, we go into some kind of forgetful, daydreamy, zone, space out, thought constructed reality of something that's not really happening. We're living in the past, we're living in a fantasy, we're living in the future, but we're not living in the present moment. In fact, we don't know there's a present moment. We have forgotten it. And that's what mindfulness is. Mindfulness remembers this present moment. There's other qualities of mind that recognize, you know, it's sanya or perception, which I've put down in the bottom here, in these lower four. Sanya and perception is what recognizes. That's what it does. It recognizes familiar experience. That's not mindfulness. It's perception that recognizes, oh, this is familiar. I've seen this. I've felt this kind of experience before. But it's mindfulness that remembers or doesn't forget. This is it. This is the moment. Not getting lost in past, future. And I say getting lost because we can be mindful of thinking about the past. We can be mindful of planning the future. We can be mindful of creating a fantasy. But we're aware that that's what's happening in the present moment. We're not lost in the past, the future, or the fantasy. So I want to make that point to that. Non-forgetfulness, the function, this is what mindfulness does. The other quality of mindfulness that I want to point out, emphasize, is its manifestation. Its manifestation is called the guardianship. It guards the mind. It guards the mind. It's like, mindfulness is like the gatekeeper of the mind. And, you know, even as we sit here, there are sounds coming in through the ear door. Right? If you're alive and your ears work, you're hearing sounds. You may not be aware of it. That's okay. But your mind is registering. Sounds are being heard. It is the function of mindfulness to recognize, oh, sounds are being heard, and not just to get irritated. If you get irritated, mindfulness isn't guarding the mind. The sounds come in the ear door, it's a little bit unpleasant, it will give rise to irritation or frustration or somebody going out there and telling them, go away, don't run that now, we're having talking in here. Right? Or even the mind wants to do that. If that's what's happening, oh, the awareness or mindfulness wasn't guarding the mind from falling into the defilements, some kind of reaction to what is actually going on. But if we just sit here and say, oh, hearing's happening. Right, hearing's happening. Or maybe the temperature is a little too cool for you or a little too warm for you. And this is also being registered by the mind in an ongoing, continual, or recurring way. It's mindfulness that will guard the mind from feeling irritated that it's too cool, or feeling indulgent that it's just right and you can fall asleep. It's mindfulness that guards the mind in that way. And it does it by actually confronting the object. The object in this case is that sound. It's not a lawnmower, it's not a weed whacker, or whatever those things are. It's the sound. And it, you know, we might say, that's an unpleasant sound. So it's mindfulness, awareness, that confronts that object and just says, I see you. That's it. I see you. That's what the mindfulness says. Got it. Taking notice of it. Just noticing that's what's going on. Not forgetting. And the characteristic of mindfulness is it's called not wobbling and not floating away. Of all the things that are going on right now in this room, there's the body feeling the temperature, the mind's knowing that, there's the ears hearing sound, the mind is knowing that, there's thoughts in the mind trying to make sense of what this guy up front is saying. and mindfulness is aware of that. And there's all kinds of other things going on in the body, in the environment, that the mind is taking notice of. We might think that the mind is just kind of globally, just kind of taking in this whole package and just kind of holding it all. But actually, in each moment, it is piercing. It is going into that sound. If you really want to hear that sound, you just steady your attention. Okay, let's take the temperature. That sounds not happening anymore. So let's take the temperature. So if you turn your attention to the temperature that you feel in the room, the temperature in the body, how do you do that? You feel it. Feel it. It's like you steady your attention. You steady your attention on some area of the body where you feel this temperature. On your skin, on your arms, on your neck, wherever. And then you steady. And then the mind drops into it. It kind of drops into the feeling. It doesn't wobble away. It doesn't float away. It doesn't just get carried along by a stream of thought about the temperature. It actually goes into the mind. You actually let the mind sink into the experience. This is characteristic of mindfulness. It doesn't float away with the object. It actually pierces it, or we say it doesn't wobble. It goes into it. My teacher, Pandita, he says, mindfulness is like a fork. When you're trying to eat a plate of peas, you know, forks are not the best thing for eating peas, because, you know, a spoon would be better. But that's not the way mindfulness works. Mindfulness works by going, chook. You know, and you have to have right aim. You have to have very precise aim. And if you try too hard, if you go like that, oh, the pea is just going to slip out of the way. But if you just go kind of like, you know, the pea will just kind of roll to the side, and you also don't pierce it. So you've got to have just the right aim, right? If you aim at the side of the plate, you're not going to get the pea. Same with your awareness. If you're aiming at, oh, just kind of some place nearby the present moment, you don't get it. But on the other hand, if you try too hard, you say, I'm going to get that sucker. You break the plate. Well, you break your mind. You know, it's just like you get really tense, you know, and your mind gets fractured. It gets kind of scattered. It gets kind of shattered if you try too hard. So you have to try with just the right balance of, well, a precise aim and the right balance of effort. If you get over-efforting, it's like trying too hard. We've all done that. If you're too languid, you kind of don't like peas, you know, just kind of like, not going to happen either. You're going to starve. So mindfulness is the ability to aim precisely and to turn your attention, your mindful attention to the object, and actually pierce it. And you pierce it in order to actually taste it. If you don't, you know, get the pea caught on the fork, you'll never taste the pea. Same with mindfulness. If you don't actually get the mindfulness into the object, you don't know the flavor of that object. You can't really identify it. You just kind of know its shape, its color, but you don't really get the taste. We know peas are green and round, but until you get it on the fork and get it in the mouth, no taste. Same with the mindfulness, awareness. We can see generally in kind of a general way, or we can be mindful of the temperature of the room. But if you really want to taste the temperature of the room with your mind, well, you have to sink into it. You have to set your mind into it like a fork into a pea. When we do that, then we say that the mind is actually confronting the object. You know, the mind is the mindfulness is the guardian of the mind. It keeps out the defilements. It looks at everything that's coming into the mind and says, you can come in, you can come in, you can come in, you can't come in. I don't want the defilements in there. So we listen to the sound, we say the sound can come in, yes. The irritation, no, you can't come in. Or the temperature can come in. But the dislike of the temperature? No, you can't come in. Mindfulness says that. Because mindfulness cannot coexist with any of the defilements. Or I should say, none of the defilements can coexist with mindfulness. Now, wait a minute. Haven't you heard Mark say, you know, when you feel irritated or you know, upset, be mindful of it.
Do you say that?
Yeah, I do too. But the difference is, in the moment that you're upset, you're not being mindful. But when you turn your attention to it, your mindful attention to it, you can be mindful of that. You can be mindful of the feeling of irritation or the urge in the mind to be upset or excited or fearful or whatever the defilement happens to be. But at that point, you're no longer indulging in it. There's an awareness of it. And while I'm on that topic, there's a huge difference between being anxious, thinking about your anxiety, and being aware of anxiety. Huge difference. Because when we're anxious, it's really unpleasant, it's really uncomfortable, we feel like crap. You know, it's just like, you know how it is. Don't you? Yeah, we do. But when we think about it, we try to solve, and we try to fix it, we try to figure it out. You know, we're thinking about, why am I so anxious? Well, it's because we also still don't feel very good. Because no matter what we think about it, we're still anxious. But being mindful of anxiety, there's a... Now, this is a three-dimensional instruction, so you have to watch me now. So there's anxiety. When we're anxious, it's like this. Awareness is wrapped up in the anxiety. So we feel anxious. When we're thinking about anxiety, it's kind of like... We're kind of going like this. We're kind of like getting the texture. We're kind of getting the outlines of the anxiety, but we're not clear about it yet. Being aware of anxiety is like this. Anxiety is here. It just lands in the mind. Oh. But the mind is not absorbed in or lost in the anxiety or any of the other defilements. There's the anxiety and awareness of it. So what we're trying to do with this practice is to have the clarity of awareness to take it out of the unwholesome defilement. So that there's this clear seeing. Now, some people say, yeah, but that's like cutting it off or separating yourself from your experience or getting some distance or being too objective. But actually, if there's anxiety there or any other defilement, you feel it. You feel it. You feel it mentally, and it conditions feelings or sensations in the body, which can also be tracked. The sensations in the body are not the mental state, but strong mental states can condition and do condition sensations arising in the body. So when we are aware of a mental state, it's as if we extract the awareness, mindfulness, from the mental state, and we turn and look at it. Like that, or like that. So that there's both a subjective feeling of it, but an objective knowing of it. This is called mindfulness. This is the proximate cause for mindfulness, is having a clear perception. Clear perception is the ability to distinguish what the unique taste of this experience is, whether it's a pea or a potato. So you taste this mental state. Now I've been talking for half hour already. What's your mental state? Just take a look. What's your mental state? Boredom? Curiosity? Excitement, sleepiness, disinterest, I don't give a hootness. What's your mental state? Only you know. Only you can know. And the only way you can know is to, kind of come out of it. Turn around, take a look. What is this? Remembering this present moment, because that's what's going on in this moment, is that mental state. Now, the next thing is, if you are feeling bored, and you don't become aware of it, then you'll suffer. You really won't want me to keep talking. You'll just say, shut the up. Because, you know, this is boring. Let's get on to something more exciting. Right? But if you can, just be aware of boredom. Well, then that's kind of fascinating. What do you know about boredom? We've been bored before. We've been sleepy before. We've been excited. We've been depressed. We've been anxious. We've been fretful, fearful. Awareness is the practice of learning about these states of mind and really being able to taste the difference between fear and anxiety, the difference between depression and despair, the difference between excitement and indulgence, or the difference between awareness and what we call more or less awareness. Because each one of those mental states has its own flavor. And that flavor is called, is only knowable by having a clear perception. And clear perception, if you look down in the bottom here, perception is, it perceives the quality of an object. It actually tastes. It is what tastes and recognizes the quality. Whether, for example, whether you feel warm or cool, it is perception that will tell you what the temperature is and will give you that accurate appraisal. Same with the qualities of the mind. If your perception is strong, you'll be able to notice and distinguish this mental state from others. For example, you'll be able to distinguish, for example, depression from despair. Now, they're pretty close. They're pretty close. But there's subtle differences. If you know the nature of depression and you know the nature of despair, you'll know the difference and you'll know the similarities. So this is what clear perception recognizes. It recognizes the uniqueness of this particular moment. How are we doing? You with me? Okay. We're just talking about mindfulness now. We're going to get over this because everybody knows about mindfulness, right? Okay. And I want to get into the three energizing qualities, because this is what's required to kind of initially emerge from our deeply conditioned sleep. You know, when we grow up in our family, in our culture, when we go to school, we get conditioned into seeing things, believing things, experiencing things in the way we're taught. We can't just see things as they are and know them for ourselves. We have to learn from our parents. Is this good or is this bad? We learn from our culture. Is this good or is this bad? Should I do this or not? And if we don't get that kind of guidance, instruction, we don't differentiate anything. And it's very difficult to live in the world in a consensual reality if you're not able to differentiate and have a kind of a similar understanding as the other people around you. That's why you go to a foreign country, you can see what people are doing, but you don't really understand it. It's like, I wonder why they're doing that. I had this experience in Burma a lot. We go into, you know, some village and we're trying to figure out how many kids they got and whether they need a new school or something. And they're talking in Burmese, and I don't understand Burmese. And they're screaming and arguing and hollering and having a heck of a time. And I think, holy geez, I only asked them how many kids go to school. You know, some, and, you know, after 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, they still haven't told us what's going on. So I asked the translator, what's going on? And they're having a discussion about something that we don't care about. He said, oh, well, we can't tell you that, because if you know that some of the girls aren't going to school, and that maybe you won't build a school. We'll build a school, but we want the girls to go to school, too. And they said, well, you know, if you ask to put your name on that school building, like this school was donated by Steve Armstrong, the government doesn't like that. So we have to find a way to tell you, yes, we'd like a school. Yes, we'll get the girls to go, but you can't put your name on the school. We didn't ask them if we wanted a name on the school. But that's what they heard. They thought, if we donate, then we want our name on the school. We don't want that. It's just their cultural interpretation, a mistaken view of what, because if a Burmese person goes to donate a school, they want their name on it. It's like, oh, okay, well, we're running into this all the time with each other. Different people having different beliefs. My hostess yesterday from the East Coast said that we were pulling into a Kinko's parking lot, and somebody cut us off, took the only remaining parking spot, and I said, she said, oh, you're from the East Coast, I can tell. People in Minnesota don't do that. They'd say something else. And I thought, yeah, it's true. You know, I mean, I don't know what you guys would say, but you know, our cultural history goes with us wherever we go. What's that all about? Can't remember. So when we look at the three energizing factors of mind, these are the qualities of mind that really wake us up from our slumber, wake us up from just kind of droning on through life in our deeply conditioned and habitual ways that we've learned from our parents. And you know, look, it's comfortable. You know, I mean, it's kind of comfortable to just be asleep to life and just do what you've been taught and just kind of see things the same way your parents see them and just kind of go through. But there's just enough discomfort in life to kind of try to wake you up. So when we intentionally take our practice and we take up awareness, we need to generate usually a lot of energy to be able to sustain the interest and the energy for looking through the lens of our conditioning to see things the way they really are. These are the investigation, energy, and joy, the three qualities of mind that are very enlivening of the mind, and therefore awakening and enlivening of the body also. But actually we say that investigation, mindfulness, investigation, and energy are the only three of the seven factors that you can do anything about. Those are the ones that you can intentionally cultivate. You can cultivate mindfulness, you can cultivate investigation, you can cultivate energy. But joy, calm, concentration, and equanimity, they are the result of the development of the other three. We'll get into this a little later as we talk about it. But I just want to give an overview of the three energizing qualities. Investigation is really not by thinking. It's not investigating by reading more books or doing some research. It's the investigation with awareness. You know, as I said, if you want to really know what the temperature of the room is, you have to investigate it. Not by looking at the thermostat, but by feeling it in the body and knowing for yourself through your direct experience of the temperature of the body what this is. This is what this investigation is pointing to. Is how to know the present moment's experience as it really is. Not what you think about it, not what you've been told, not what the thermostat says, but how you experience it. Energy, and I want to mention what I did last night. There's a lot of different kinds of energy, mental and physical, and the different energy required in practice. There's the as I was telling somebody yesterday, there's the energy of initiating, starting something up. And it's often very exciting to start something, to start a relationship, or to start school, or to start a job, or to start meditation practice. And even when we start a single sitting, we gear up some energy and we kind of hold ourselves up and remember what we're doing and start. That's one kind of energy. But, you know, midway through the sitting, you get this kind of cruising energy. It's kind of like, not startup energy more, it's kind of like cruising energy. It's like when you're halfway through the book You know, it's like, okay, it's not quite as exciting as I thought. It's a little more work than I thought. But we're just kind of cruising. It takes a different kind of energy to sustain the energy, huh? To sustain the momentum. Startup energy would be too much. That would take you to another book. Take you to another state of mind. But to just support the momentum of what's already going on. And then there's the energy to finish. You know, the energy it takes to finish a project is not startup energy. It's not problem-solving energy. It's not even sustain the momentum energy. It's different. You know, how do you end a sitting? How do you end a retreat? How do you end a book? You're reading a book or writing a book? How do you do that? What kind of energy does it take? It takes a very enduring energy. If you get too excited, it takes you off. If you don't sustain it, it stops short. It takes the energy of just sustaining in a very gentle but precise way. You know, kind of bringing the end of the project, bringing the end of the sitting, bringing the end of your life into view and wrapping it up. It takes very different energy. I often say to people, you know, when you're on retreat, you know, you've been on retreat for 6 or 7 days, 8 days, and the retreat is going to end in another day, I say, watch carefully. Because how you end a retreat, or even how you end this day's workshop, is indicative of how you'll end your life. What's he talking about? Like, who said? Well, it is. You know, can you really hold your attention on something until it comes to its natural end? Or do you just space out? Do you just lose it? Do you not know when things end? This is an important question to ask yourself in your practice, really. When you sit down to practice, we always have some intention at the beginning of the sitting. Where's your intention at the end of the sitting? Is it already into the next activity? You'll be reborn many times before you learn to let go of that one. Or is it right there, willing to just see this come to an end? With nothing to do. Imagine if you finished everything on your to-do list. Imagine. You just wrap it up. You got that kind of finish it up energy. You wrap it all up. The last project and the last thing. And you wrapped it all up. What would that feel like? Would it be exciting? Would it be quiet? Would you scramble around to get something else? Would you have a sense of relief? Would you feel bored? Would you feel empty? Would you feel fulfilled? Again, it's only by paying careful attention to each moment that we're going to know what happens when we bring a sitting to an end, or the day's workshop to an end, or our life to an end. And this is an important kind of energy to begin to recognize or begin to work with in practice so that we cultivate the sustaining energy. Energy that really sustains and not collapses. Last night I was talking about... Well, how many were here last night? Okay, how many weren't here? Huh. 50-50. Okay, so last night I was talking about... Now this is another visual instruction. Last night I was talking about the energy like this. You know, you're sitting, you're doing something, and then at some point you go... Do you see that? Yeah, you're going along, being present, and then you go. That's when your energy collapses. But energy has the manifestation of non-collapsing. If there is energy, the mind doesn't collapse. That's when the mind collapses, it goes. You know, and when the mind collapses, the body the body collapses. Because the mind is no longer there to support it. The mind's gone somewhere. And so the body is not, is left mindless. No mind in the body. So we want to learn to recognize when this kind of energy, or to be able to distinguish, I should say, the very subtle energy of wrapping things up, the very just sustaining energy, and the collapse of energy. Because once you collapse, then no more awareness. And we're lost. I've been talking too long, or a long time. Now, I've talked about mindfulness and some of the energizing qualities, and you've all practiced a lot. I know you've all been doing practice. Or you're engaged in your life. I want to ask a question like this. How do you experience over-energized mind in your practice of life, or under-energized mind in your practice of life? That's the question. Do you have energy in your life? Do you feel energetic in your life? Do you feel lethargic in your life, in your practice? When you sit down, are you more kind of like on top of things, or kind of underneath things?
The primary way I experience too little energy is through wandering mind on the cushion.
Wandering mind as an experience of too little energy.
Yeah, the trick is applying the right type of energy without overdoing it. I'm still learning how to do that.
Now, what's your name?
Mark.
Mark. Now, I have this kind of habit of taking everything anybody says as an opportunity to teach something. So don't take it personal, okay? So I kind of have to ask for your permission to kind of use you as an example. You know, when I notice restlessness in my mind, I never feel like I have too little energy. It always feels like too much energy. So I'm surprised, you know, restlessness is like, wow, the mind is just going, doo, doo, doo. So it's like, hold it. Like that. You know, thinking about this, thinking about that, jumping from here, jumping there, just kind of racing. So I wouldn't think that restlessness is an experience of too little energy. What do you think?
I think there are two types of wandering mind. The one I was thinking of, the type you described, the one I'm thinking of is more of a dullness, just a drifting because I can't get enough a good healthy sense of urgency to stay with the present.
You use sense of urgency. Where does that say now? There's some place here. Sense of urgency.
Approximate cause of energy.
Oh, yeah. Sense of urgency. How come?
I'm asking you.
Well, you know, what we say about a sense of urgency is that's a samvega. Samvega is spiritual urgency. It rests on the unawareness. This is kind of harsh, but it rests on the lack of awareness that you're going to die. And you don't know when. And it could be right in the next moment. Because if you know, and the Buddha was very instructive. He said, every day you should reflect on death. Not just death general, but death, your death. But we each should reflect on our own death every day. Why? Because it's a fact, right? We're going to die. And there isn't anybody in the room that knows when or how. And so not knowing when and not knowing how, but knowing that we're going to, it could be any time. Doesn't that make you want to go, okay, let me just kind of pay attention. I want to be here for it if it's going to happen, right? So if you're feeling collapsed, not much energy, just kind of drifting in this dull state, what can you do about that? Somebody else had a hand up here. You.
I experienced a lot of.
Can you tell me your name?
Oh, yeah, Jana.
Jana, right.
I experienced similar kind of drifting a lot in my. That seems like it's from a lack of energy, and I think it's sort of not being interested or thinking that what I'm doing is important. That it's sort of like that's the next cause of why I'm sort of just a little collapsed. It doesn't seem like I'm a little confused, and I don't think that what I'm doing is interesting or important.
Now I understand what you're both talking about. You're talking about the mind just floating away. Right? Really. It's just floating away. It's just like the mindfulness is not here in the moment. It just kind of floats away. Well, that's what mindfulness is. Not floating away. Actually, we say not fading away. But that's the Grateful Dead phrase. So don't fade away. Not fade away. You know? Not fade away. So what can you do to actually strengthen mindfulness? Look on the map now. This little map is going to tell you. If you're floating away, and you both had this experience of floating away, you look and say, oh, not floating away. I need some more mindfulness. What's the cause for mindfulness? Oh, strong perception. Right? What would strong perception be in that kind of experience?
The awareness that your mind is moving.
There you go. What's actually happening in the present moment? Mindfulness only knows what's happening in the present moment. What's happening in the present moment is floating away. If you can have a clear perception, oh, the mind's floating away, what happens? No, wait, you gotta.
Huh?
You're mindful. And? What? And it's not floating away? Now, wait a minute. Just because you're mindful of something, does that mean it stops? No. Sometimes you can be mindful of something and it just keeps going on and on and on. Like what?
A pain.
Well, let's look at that. Okay, so now you have a pain. You know, where?
The knee.
Knee, okay, so you got a pain in the knee. First we think, I got a pain in my knee, right? And the mind, you know, it's a very strong sensation, and the mindfulness goes right there, right? And then mindfulness notices what?
It changes.
It changes. From?
Piercing to aching.
From pain to piercing to aching to?
Vibrating.
Vibrating. See, every one of them is going away.
Heat.
Right? Is it, does it go away? Does the pain go away because of awareness? Does the aching go away because of awareness? Does the stabbing go away because of awareness? No. No? Why? Why does the pain go away? Why does the aching go away? Why does the stabbing go away?
It's nature
change. So it's its nature change. So whether you're mindful of it or not, it's going to go away.
It's going to do whatever it does.
So, why should we get upset about anything? It's going to go away anyway. Right?
That's true. Yeah, but it feels like pain sometimes feels like a relief in a way because it gets me away from torpor.
So you're thankful for pain because it keeps you from being torpored.
I don't deal with a lot of people with pain. I deal with torpors. So pain is sort of a nice
I think I would just strengthen perception. Forget the pain part. Just strengthen your perception. You strengthen your perception, it really get clear. Get a clear recognition of what's going on. Then you do it. Clear perception is the direct antidote to torpor. It is. Because torpor is you know, heaviness of mind, inactivity of mind, unwillingness to register what's going on. Perception is recognizing what's going on. Right? So we've talked about restlessness, and we talked about torpor, we talked about pain, we talked about the nature of everything is to change. What have we left out?
You asked about the overactive mind also.
Overactive mind. Hey, let's do a survey. Thanks for the reminder. You know, if you had to classify yourself kind of generally as the high metabolism, active or to the point of sometimes overactive type, or kind of the sluggish, low energy, slow metabolism, maybe more tranquil type. Okay, that's the spectrum. How many are on the overactive, high intense, you know, kind of like wound up side? Was that about 50%? How many are on the sluggish, slow? Wow.
How about the old extreme? I only have
2 feet. You only what?
I only have 2 feet.
That's called being bipolar in the spiritual sense, psychopharmacological sense. Now I have a question. Which do you prefer? The high metabolism? You like that high energy, kind of like really alert on top of things, really bent that? Or do you prefer the kind of low, sluggish, kind of tranquil, soporific? Now wait a minute, some people aren't voting here.
You want the middle path.
Which is? Now wait a minute, you can be mindful if you're really high energy and kind of wound up and just kind of like on top of things. And you can be mindful of very kind of calm, tranquil, content, easeful. Can do.
Different.
Say it again?
Well, in my experience, I like content and peaceful. I mean, I like excitement a lot, but I also like content and peaceful. The torpor is very different from content and peaceful.
Sure. Yeah, we'll get to that. We'll get to the content and peaceful later. This afternoon. Yeah.
So, the point that I'm puzzled about is whether you're talking about the restlessness in the mind, and the torpor
in the mind versus the restlessness and energy in life.
In
life.
Very energetic in life.
Right?
A lot of torpor in the mind.
Oh. So. What's the difference? I mean, okay, so the question is, are we talking about, you know, kind of restlessness and high energy in life or in the mind? I can't. Yeah, it's like I don't know how to live life without my mind.
No, I mean, it's like I'm fascinated that in my life I have a tremendous amount of energy, and I can do lots of stuff, and I like it, and enjoy it. But when I come and I sit, oh my God, I'm just gone. I mean, I just feel like I say it every time I'm sleeping, and that's where I'm puzzled. I'm just puzzled about that.
Anybody got any kind of analytical understanding of what she's talking about? Yeah?
Well, I think the middle way is not necessarily this balance that we have to be in the middle. It's just being aware of the two extremes.
Two ends of the spectrum. So that when you're on one end of the spectrum, that's okay. You're just not oblivious to the other end of the spectrum. Is that what you mean?
Lots of stimulation, all the stuff going on. So when that gets is absent,
then all the tiredness sinks in. And when there's the absence of stimulation, then you sort of shut down because all during the day you're responding to stimulation.
Any other comments? Yeah?
Would an opposite of that be your mind obsessing, 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 obsessing about something and then not actually doing anything of it too? So there you are. The mind is just going like wild and then, but you're not actually carrying out any action.
That certainly is a draining. You know, when we get obsessive and we're not really resolving anything, can be very draining. I think she's talking about something a little bit different, but that's a good point, yeah?
One other thought is it could be possible to be very active without a lot of mindfulness. You talked about all that conditioning.
Yeah. I tended to think all the activity, the busyness, the excitement of your life, is kind of in the movement of the mind and the body, but not really awareness of the body and the mind. Because if at the end of, you know, that activity you're tired, you're exhausted, and you just collapse, then there hasn't been awareness there.
What if you're not?
Pardon? What if you're not? Oh, sit down with your eyes closed. Yeah, you're tired. I think that, I think it's kind of a national malaise is to not recognize when we're tired. You know, I don't think you're alone. I think it's quite prevalent because we're so used to being stimulated, and we're so unused to being calm and just present in a wakeful way with calmness, that we don't realize what tiredness is.
I wonder if you could say a little more about now.
Rest.
Last night you were talking about when you were at the monastery, how you were meant to be really wakeful for 20 hours. And how can it be restful to be awake and energetic in this way?
Yeah. So the question is about how can it be restful to be awake for 20 hours a day, right? Well, we're going to get into the tranquilizing factors of mind more this afternoon, and we'll talk about that.
I just wonder, I've seen it sort of hearing, like, it seems like there's like too much activity. There's a point where it's not possible to be mindful of above a certain point, because there's so much going on that it's almost like an assembly line, like, you know, some of the flawed foods just go by, and you can only get so many off of the roller before it, and so maybe mindfulness gives the information that you have to slow down the production line in order to pay attention to every fruit, every moment, otherwise it's just not possible.
That sounds very convincing. But I want to give you another example. In August, when the night sky is full of Pleiades, you know, all the shooting stars. If you want to see the shooting stars in the sky, how do you do that? Well, you go to a nice dark place, and you open your eyes, and you don't focus on anything, and yet you see everything. If there's you got the whole sky in your vision, no matter where the shooting star goes, you see it, but you're not looking at that particular spot. So you have very panoramic awareness. Why couldn't you be very panoramically aware of everything that's going on, even if you're busy, and if you're doing a lot? Why couldn't there be awareness of a lot? Who's to say that you have to see things one at a time? Do, 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 do. And how many ones are there at a time? You know? I just wanted to challenge that, you know, I could see every little thing. Do, do, do. I don't, think so. Because let me just say that in practice, we often think that we've got to slow down. We've got to slow down our mind, we've got to slow down our body in order to be aware of doom-da-doom-da-doom-da-doom, right? And I've taught this for years, so if you believe it, well, I understand why. But actually, in the beginning, maybe that's necessary, just so we feel stable, so we feel confident that we're seeing things. Doom, 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 doom. But there's plenty of times in practice when mindfulness is really sharp and alert, panoramic, and things are going by like crazy. And no problem, not being strung out by it, not being exhausted by it. So it's kind of like, you know, if there's a train going by, and you're standing just 3 feet away from the train. Oh my God, this is like, it's too intense. You can't kind of register all that's happening, right? But if you just step back a little further, and this is what Vipassana does. Vipassana steps back to see things. And you just step back, you know, 10 yards. Train's going by at the same speed, and yet not nearly so overwhelming, and you can keep up with it. You can count the cars going by. It's going by at the same speed, but you, in this case, have a different perception of it because of the distance from it. Vipassana does that. Vipassana steps back from things. Samadhi, or concentration, goes into things. So when you step back, you see things from a different perspective. You have a different perception of them, really, to use this different perception. And you can take in a lot more in a shorter amount of time. So can we have panoramic mindfulness in everyday activity of life? That's the question. Mm-hmm. What do you think?
Yes.
We better have. Yeah. Really? Because, you know, in a couple minutes we're going to take a short break. And there's going to be 90 people. We're going to get up and we're all going to go out two doors and we're going to head for four bathrooms. Right? And somehow we're not going to get into a fight. You know, we're not going to bump into each other. We're going to be panoramically aware of just the way it goes, the flow, the dynamic. We're going to be aware of everything that's going on. So when we do take a break, watch, you know, how panoramic your attention is. What it notices. Just notice what it notices visually. Notice what it notices sound-wise, too. Because we don't have to, we don't have to narrow our focus. Practice. Mindfulness, if you look here for mindfulness, it doesn't say anything about narrow your focus. To be mindful. It's got nothing, mindfulness has nothing to do with narrowing the focus to a single object or to a small area or to a single thing. It just says not forgetting, not floating away, guarding the mind, strong perception. Okay, can we do that in everyday pace? With kind of a panoramic awareness. We're going to have an opportunity to practice in a minute.
And I don't know if you want to address this now, but I was interested to hear more about asana, stepping back and samadhi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so there's a question about the vipassana stepping back and the samadhi going in. This afternoon we're going to be talking about samadhi or concentration. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that, what that kind of movement of mind is, and remind me then to distinguish more clearly about the vipassana stepping back and mindfulness of samadhi going in. I'm going to go him and then you.
Question. Panoramic mindfulness work in peace?
Can panoramic mindfulness work on peace?
Yeah.
That's
somewhat contradictory.
That's eating with a spoon. No. No. Yeah. Yes.
That's the point of just using that in Marcus, that it helps with the deacon to stay
up. Yes. Now, let me think. We can only take these metaphors of these images so far, you know. It's like, okay. You know when you have a fork that has just one tine on it? Nobody ever has a fork that's one tine on it. That's called a spoon. But, you know, and you have a fork that has four tines on it. Maybe you can get three peas at once. Huh? But, rather than think of it that way, if you're very precise and you have a very sharp fork and you're very quick, you can go chook, 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 and you can get two, three, four, five in a row, so to speak. So it's more like that. Sometimes it feels like you're getting three at once. Sometimes it feels like you're getting three sequentially, very quickly.
What was the question?
The question is about how many peas can you pick up with a fork? Who asked the question? No, because he was saying, can panoramic awareness work with multiple objects? It's like how many peas can you get on the fork?
I thought you said
peas. Oh, peas. No, we're back at the peas and pears. Okay, you had a comment?
The same.
Same question. That's an interesting phenomenon. Yeah.
Well, I got two things now. I wanted to go back first of all to David's question about sleep and rest, and I know you're going to address this later, so I want to throw this out so you can possibly address it later or something. But I remember reading, in the last few years, of some young American Westerner who went, I thought he was in Thailand, to study and practicing there, and got an opportunity to go to a retreat in Korea. He got that opportunity because somebody gave him a good recommendation. So he got there to do this retreat and was told, we're going to go 24/7, you know, 24 hours a day for 7 days, you're going to be meditating, no sleep. And he's arguing this, but he didn't want to make people give him the recommendation to go bad for it. And, you know, and he did. And I was discussing this last night after your talk with somebody else, and was curious about how do you rest for 7 days without sleeping? Is it during your meditation that actually stimulates you? So I like
to How to sleep while sitting up in a pyramid. I gotta tell you, this is something teachers learn really quick. How to get a little nap while
different thing, having all these different things happening in your life at one time.
Yeah.
So it takes me back to the 60s and 70s when I was a different.
When what?
And we did a little smoking here and there. And,
among other things.
I was so amazed that I can listen to music like an hour when I was straight, and I was hear music. Oh my God. Altered the state and listen to music. I heard every little thing. You'd hear the guitar riff, and then you'd hear the drums, and then you'd hear something. And they were all like, in actuality, taking place at the same time. So I was aware of each of those individual things in my mind. And somehow, the music had to get going.
Are you suggesting an alternative to a mindfulness practice?
The mind has
fantastic capacity that mostly is unavailable to us in our ordinary wakefulness. But when you develop mindful awareness, you can have very different perceptions of ordinary reality. And that's where we come to understand the deficiency of our ordinary perceptions of things. And we begin to kind of question them, or we begin to just not take them as so solid. Our perceptions are conditioned by past and conditioned by the degree of awareness in the mind. And if you strengthen the awareness and you become more concentrated or the mind becomes more collected, you will be looking at the same thing and have very different perception of it. Yeah. It doesn't mean that the original perception was wrong. It doesn't mean that this is more right. It just gives you a different understanding of the nature of reality. And that's useful, to loosen the grip of conditioned understanding of reality. Yeah. Drugs do it very well, but they're just not sustainable. Yeah. So, let's take a break. It's a little after 11, but just, this is a stand up, take a pee, get a tea, get a sip of water, and back in 8 minutes, 5 to 8 minutes, something like that. Did I give you a homework assignment during the break?
No.
I did.
The panoramic theater.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, what did you notice? It was noisy. It was a lot going on.
I forgot.
You forgot to do that?
Forgot. But that's partly true.
This is the problem. We forget. Yeah. We got about an hour before we'll break for lunch, and I wanted to mention the other. I want to spend some time with the three energizing factors because they are. I think they're what we have to work with the most in the beginning of our practice. Is to really generate the right kind of energy, the right kind of interest or joy. And the right kind of investigation or understanding. So I want to look at these a little bit. I mentioned energy, you know, the different kinds of energy, the arousing energy, the sustaining energy, the kind of the supporting the momentum of energy, and the energy being the non-collapse of the mind, really. That when we're talking about energy, we're not primarily talking about physical energy of doing a lot or really tiring ourselves out physically, but really supporting the mind to be in touch with the present moment, or supporting the mind to not fade away from the present moment, to be willing to confront the present moment. And as I mentioned earlier, that the energy, the traditional maybe even the fundamentalist cause for the arousing of that kind of energy is a sense of urgency. And there are many different, they say there are eight causes or eight factors, eight reflections for arousing sambhaga, for spiritual urgency, or the urgency to be willing to be here, to recognize the aliveness of the present moment. One of them being death and all the others. I want to talk about joy a little bit. I know that one of the teachers on the West Coast, James Braz, has a course now, I'm not selling it, but called Awakening Joy, in which he has a lot of affirmation, really, for, you know, just consciously bringing joy into your life and practice, and the value of that, because, or the need for that, because of so much conditioning in the other direction. Kind of the unjoy part of life, or the burdensomeness part of life, which sometimes you get pretty heavy in Dharma circles too. But the joy that we're talking about here in these seven factors of awakening is not primarily the joy that you can arouse intentionally. It's not primarily the thinking about something that makes you happy and joyful. That's not the joy that we're talking about here. The joy that we're talking about here is the kind of experience in the mind, or mental experience, that occurs when the hindrances are put aside for a sustained period of time. And the hindrances are put aside for a sustained period of time when mindfulness is fairly continuous. The more continuous mindfulness is, the longer the hindrances don't get a chance to take over the mind. And what happens is that through the continuity of awareness, just moment to moment, being with whatever has called your attention, whether it's the chosen object, like the breath or posture, or whether it's random predominant objects, like sight, sound, sensations, thoughts, mood, feelings, or whether it's just a choiceless panoramic awareness of anything and everything. When the mind can do its work of knowing unhindered, it takes great delight. When the mind can do its work of knowing unhindered, meaning without any of the defilements, which are all about, I mean, all the defilements are about, are putting the spin of me on impersonal experience. All the defilements are about me. They're all about my wants, my needs, my fears, my joys, my sorrows, my depression, my misunderstanding, my, me. And so when those can be put aside or seen through or not absorbed in for a period of time, then the mind does its thing. Now the mind has just an endless capacity for energy. The mind is an endlessly energetic thing, activity. And even when we go to sleep, when we fall asleep in the traditional understanding of the word, you know, go to bed, lay down, pass out, unaware, the mind is still going. The mind is still working. We're churning out all kinds of dreams and perceptions, and the mind is registering all that's going on in the room, even while we would say are unaware of it. When we practice awareness intensively and really strengthen the non-forgetting and strengthen the clarity of perception, then just because we lay down and go to sleep doesn't mean that mindfulness, non-forgetting, and perception, clarity of recognition, goes to sleep. They don't. Mindfulness stays. If it's developed during the day, while you're normally awake, it is just as developed in the evening when you fall asleep. So many people report when they're practicing mindfulness intensively that their dreams are much more vivid. And their dreams aren't much more vivid. Their mindfulness is much more clear. And their perception is much more distinguished. And so not forgetting means remembering, right? So when we dream and when we've been practicing awareness intensively during the day and we dream, we're not so likely to forget. We're likely to remember, and it's likely to be more vivid. But when the mind can do its work of knowing present moment experience without the defilements, then it... to say the mind takes delight is kind of funny, because the mind is not a personality, so to speak. But it does. There's a word that they use in talking about food. You know, when you have the five tastes in perfect balance in some concoction or some food substance, when the five tastes are in perfect balance, you get an effect called amplitude, where the taste is more than the sum of the five flavors. It's the five flavors on steroids, like that. Well, the same thing happens when the mind, when the factors of mind, of mindfulness, you know, connecting, sustaining, and attention, and mindfulness, and faith, and all of those factors of mind that arise with awareness, when they reach some level of development without hindrances, for a sustained period of time, then the mind kind of leaps to a kind of amplitude. Things get steroidal. Is that a word? It's like the mind on steroids. And so then the mind, quite naturally, we experience it as taking delight. And you can see that it says here that the function of joy is to refresh the body and the mind, or to refresh the mind, and when the mind's refreshed, it refreshes the body. There's a gradient, there's a spectrum of joyful experiences in meditation practice. Everything from which is hard to understand is joy, but you know, sometimes you're sitting and you get this this feeling of like sudden elevator drop, like that. Did you ever have that when you're meditating? You're meditating, you're going along, you get that bottom fallout. Actually, that's an initial indicator that the mind is really developing that momentum and beginning to access the joy that comes from the development of the mind. It's not because you're thinking about it. It's not because you're thinking of something pleasant and taking joy in it. It's because the functioning, the perceptual activity of the mind is unhindered and is reaching this kind of amplitude effect. And then joy, or this factor of mind that refreshes the mind and body, can develop up to and including ecstatic ecstasy that is pass-out intensity. Pass-out by the intensity of the ecstasy. And this is also quite joyful. And it has the effect of refreshing the mind, because it kind of burns everything else out of the mind. It's so intense. And then when the mind is that kind of like refreshed, the body feels very light, very energetic, very pliable, transparent, more like helium. You know, you feel like you've been filled with helium and you're just kind of like lifted off.
Slow?
Flow.
You know, that Russian man who's
Like being in the zone. You know, is that kind of like colloquially like being in the zone?
Yeah. Utterly focused.
Maybe some similarity, but I don't know enough about the characteristics of flow to say exactly. But this is very joyful. This is ecstatic. And you can't, it's unsuppressible kind of happiness comes into the mind. But it actually can be quite intense. It's kind of like, you're all old enough to have this kind of experience. It's kind of like orgasm for like hours at a time. You know, unabated orgasm for full body, every cell of your body orgasming for sometimes hours. And it's not depleting or draining, energizing. Pretty good. Yeah.
So, who's experiencing that?
mean, who's experiencing joy? And if they are, then what happens when the joy drops?
Sure. Joy arises due to conditions, causes and conditions, which are impersonal. Continuity of awareness, clarity of perception, you know, sustained energy, etc., the other factors of mind.
Also need someone
gives
time with it,
though? No, you don't need to be in a...
joyful.
No, you don't need... No, definitely not. It's not you are joyful. As soon as you get in there, I'm joyful, then you've attached to it. Defilements have entered the mind, and it'll soon undermine and contaminate that experience, and the joy will disappear.
So two different joys. One is I'm joyful, or one is like...
The I'm joyful is a very, very superficial, frankly. Very superficial. Okay, so you asked a good question. Who's experiencing this? Who's joyful? If you look down below number 7, you get to feeling Vedana, and the characteristic of Vedana is being felt. That means Vedana feels the pleasantness. You know, it's not a person. It's a capacity of mind. It's an activity of mind, feeling. Right? And when joy is that strong, Vedana is feeling pleasantness. But to identify yourself with feeling is very common. I mean, we do. You know, if the body feels pleasant, we say, I feel pleasant. When the mind is happy, we say, I'm happy. But that's a kind of a misnomer. It's really, feeling is feeling pleasantness. From the body, feeling is feeling pleasantness of the mind.
Yeah, I think what happens with me is that, like, just because there's this huge momentum of identifying with everything all the time, you know, I've just been practicing mindfulness for maybe a year and a half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure.
And, you kind of put the mind in front of the glass and everything, and it gets a little. And there's also, you know, a lot of the subtle qualities that are here are coming through. And then there's this attachment to them. And that's like this kind of roller coaster, right?
Yeah. So the comment is about really, you know, just almost impossible to prevent becoming identified with our experience. You know, so when joy is there, we get very identified with it. Or when irritation is there, we get very identified with it. When fear is there, we get very identified with it. That is, you know, the preeminent wrong view that the Buddha pointed to over and over again, that said this wrong understanding has most misled humankind from the get-go, and it has caused the suffering. What's important in coming to right view, which is not being identified with those experiences, when Sariputta, the Buddha's right hand, and second only to the Buddha in wisdom, was asked, what is the cause, or what conditions give rise to right view? Okay, because this is what we want. We want right view in relation to joy and fear and all those other things. With right view, of course, we're not identified with. And he said there are two conditions for the arising of right view. Okay? Do you know what they are? There are two conditions necessary for the arising of right view. Okay, mindfulness, concentration, non-attachment. I see some people agreeing with that. Anything else?
Non-judging.
Say it again?
Non-judging.
Non-judging. Okay.
Wisdom?
Wisdom?
Yeah.
Wisdom is right. Right view is wisdom. What's the cause, what's the conditions for the arising of that? Two things. All of what you said are close to one of them, which is wise attention. Okay? So wise attention down there that's on the bottom. Attention. It's that the confronting with the object, really paying attention. Huh? Paying attention with wisdom. But the second thing, which is actually the first in the Sariputta's list, is you have to hear right view from someone else. What the Buddha said, I mean, what Sariputta is saying is, left to your own devices, you will observe the experiences of your life through the lens of wrong view forever. Unless you are a Buddha. That's how important it is to listen to and to really hear what the Buddha said. And to hear it from those who carry that teaching forward. Because it is so counterintuitive to our immediate conditioned experience that we will believe wrongly every time. Scary, isn't it? I mean, when you think about it, it's like that's what's been going on until we run into someone who can point out right view. And so even though the momentum of our wrong view is so strong, we can't confirm right view as soon as we hear it. We still have to practice having heard that right view. We've heard it. We're skeptical. We don't get it. It's not making sense. Certainly don't see it, but we still practice. If you practice with wise attention after having heard right view, you will eventually arrive at confirming experience, empirical knowledge of right view. But if you don't hear right view before that, you won't. Oh, that's pretty... I was surprised to see that. I was surprised to hear that. Because I think a lot of us believe, I can figure it out for myself. If I just sit down, pay attention, I'm going to figure it out. Maybe. Maybe. But since you've already heard right view, relief. You know, you already heard it. It's already in there. The right view is all of these experiences, mental, physical, emotional, experiences of any of these factors of mind is impersonal. They arise due to causes and conditions which are not you, not yours, and not under your immediate control. Huh. Huh. So like, who's doing this, right? Yeah. Karma. Karma. Who's doing all this? Karma. Karma and intention. The karma of the past is throwing up this experience, and the karma of the present moment is responding or reacting to it. Karma is just rolling on, rolling out. And where are you in all that? Well, if you get identified with this experience, you are being reborn in this moment with this state of mind, suffering or not. And when this moment comes to an end, that you passes away. And another you is reborn in the next moment. It goes on a long time. Until right view, finally, is so solid, so clear, and your awareness is so consistently understanding things in this way that you don't get identified with anything.
This is where I get a little confused sometimes, okay. Because doesn't you have to make a decision to try to do these things?
Yes. So the question is, doesn't the you of this package have to make a decision to try to develop awareness, for example? Huh? Right. Yes. When we look down here at the bottom of volition, which is intention, we see that the function of it is to accumulate karma. Right? The next to the bottom. The function of volition, that's the deciding, the intending. If you intend to pay attention, if you intend to understand, if you intend to be mindful, you know, and then whatever it is you do to facilitate that is accumulated karma. Part of the karma that, or part of the result of that karma is right view. So we're not reaffirming a sense of self by making a decision. But we are accumulating karma, one of which will be strengthening of right view. Got it? No. Okay. Yeah.
then the next trap that tends to happen to me is I get judgmental if it's not working.
If you get judgmental if it's not working, what's it? Your intention.
Yeah.
So you have the intention to be mindful, you sit down, you have the intention to be mindful, and within 30 seconds, you're spaced out. And then you say, God, I can't do this. Right?
Or I get tight from effort.
Tight from effort. Like, if I just made more effort, I'd be more mindful.
If I were better at this.
If I were better at this, then I'd be more mindful.
No idea of therapist.
No. But let me just ask, anybody else ever had that kind of... This is universal. Partly it's a result of our conditioning. Our conditioning in the West is, you know, you are an agent of your life. You have control over your life. You are responsible for your life. You know, you make decisions and you bear the consequences. Right? Well, that's only about half true. Because there are so many conditions that we're dealing with in every moment that are sometimes more powerful than our intention. Right? And they win. They take the mind off in a direction other than your intention. Because those conditions are more powerful. One of them, and this is heading off into another chapter of the Abhidhamma, sorry, is fascination conditioning. So we're sitting in the room, and there's sight, sound, smells, taste, touch, and thoughts going on all the time. And yet, the mind that you're familiar with is picking something to pay attention to right now. Maybe you're noticing the temperature, maybe you're noticing what I said, maybe you're noticing the pain in your back, maybe you're fantasizing about what's for lunch, maybe you're remembering tomorrow's Easter and I wonder what blah blah blah, maybe you're noticing the fan circling in the ceiling. You know, what's to determine what you're aware of in this moment? You ever think about that? Why? You know, why in a crowd of people does a pickpocketer only see pockets? You know, they say, in a crowd, pickpocket only sees pockets. You know, so you look around a room, you look around the experience, you look around at the present moment, what do you see? You see what you have trained your mind to see. Yeah? The things that you've been most fascinated with throughout your endless wandering in samsara, that's what you see over and over and over again. Yeah? So if you've got a particularly lustful mind, you look around, all you see is nice lustable objects. You know, if you have a real averse kind of, you know, pissy mind, you look around and all you see is something to be irritated about. Yeah. It's not even personal at this point. It is due to conditions, causes and conditions, karma, deeply embedded in the mind stream that you're becoming aware of. So to say that your intention is failing because your mind doesn't do what you intend is not accurate. Not accurate. Because you never had that capacity to control the mind anyway. You're not failing at it. It's not within the power of intention to control the mind. It's just not. Right? Yeah. Or as Saito Utejaniya says, the mind is not yours. But you're responsible for it. Meaning, the mind is going to notice what it notices. Okay? You can't control that. But whatever it notices and the reaction you have to it, well, you're responsible for that. If you act out unskillfully, karma is going to reinforce some tendency of conditioning. So, where were we? I kind of lost track. I was kind of on that, but I kind of lost track of where else we were. Where?
Joy.
Okay, joy, yeah. So, refreshing the mind. When we refresh the mind, I often say to people, you know, in the sitting, you sit down, you get started, and I say, periodically throughout the sitting, refresh your mind. What would you do? Just kind of go, kind of shake your mind and just say, okay, mind, okay, what? What's going on here? Because we get into these, you know, boggy, kind of low-lying areas of the mind, and we get stuck. We get kind of in an unnoticing gaze, or we get into kind of a trance-like, soporific glaze. We get lost in kind of some kind of nothingness sometimes, and we just kind of have to kind of like, wow, what's going on here? Just kind of give your mind a shake to kind of, oh, refresh the mind. Remind, it really is a reminding yourself that the mind is noticing something. What? And if the mind has gotten absorbed into, gone into the experience of tranquility, for example, no perception, lost. Kind of cruising along, bottom trolling, I say. It's kind of like, unaware, comfortable, asleep, unaware. So you have to kind of rouse the mind again and say, okay. It's like resetting. Yeah, that's it. Reboot. You know, wake up, reboot. Reboot your mind. Oh, okay. So you refresh your mind that way. But joy does the same thing automatically when it is, when the mind is purified. It reboots the mind momentarily, just every moment, so it's like clean. So what'd your mind do when you heard that?
Judgment.
What else? Name the object, which is what? Phone ring or hearing? Huh?
Yeah, it's that phone ring.
Phone ring?
Mine
said phone ring.
Said, yeah. What
said what?
What was that?
Curiosity. Yes? Anything else?
I thought it took that hold.
You saw it take that hand?
Yeah.
Count to three. count to three before you answer it. Yeah?
Empathy?
Did anybody think?
I thought it was a refresh button.
You thought it was what? Refresh button? I was an intentional, like. Refresh button. Did anybody think, that's nice music? Yeah. All of your perceptions are accurate. They're right. But they're because of conditioning. Whatever you had as a reaction to that or a response to that sound is a deeply conditioned. You didn't choose that. You didn't have time to choose that, how to respond. Right? It was there instantly. As soon as that sound happened, boom, there was a reaction in the mind. Did you choose to say, oh, I think I'm going to enjoy that sound. I think I'm going to judge the person who didn't turn off their cell phone. You don't say that. It's already embedded in there. Because that's what the mind has done in the past. The perception. The sound is the sound. We all heard the same sound. But the understanding you have of that sound, your perception of it, is personal. Or it's personal conditioning. That's your spin. That's your spin. Mindfulness sees through the spin. Mindfulness knows hearing's happening. Without going to the who did that? What's that sound like? Mindfulness just knows, oh, hearing's happening. Without getting caught in either indulging in it with attachment or with aversion. Quick, isn't it? Mind is really quick. There's not a split second between the sound happening and your recognition and reaction to it. Split second. Quicker than that, even. It's going on all the time. So mindfulness is intention. Huh? it needs intention. We have to arouse an intention, a sense of urgency, and the energy to pay attention, to not forget the present moment, even though we don't know what the present moment is going to be. Right? So then we are arousing the energy, and we're investigating. We're willing to just be with things as they are. And what we see is our conditioning. Right? We see it. You can't avoid it. You're going to see your conditioning. If you have if you are a spiritual athlete and don't want to have any aversion or think that somehow you should be able to avoid aversion, you're going to suffer. You're going to suffer. It's not possible to avoid your conditioning. It's going to come out. So we want to have a right understanding of the conditioning that we see coming up again and again and again, all those judgments.
I was just thinking what you were saying about having a teacher who tells you and then you practice it, because I was thinking about the Thich Nhat Hanh, where the bell brings you back home or you wait 3 seconds. So practicing that the last 3 years, I actually changed my response. Prior to 3 years, I would be, I don't know what it would have been.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have been mindfulness come home. So I think
is that what you said to yourself, like mindfulness come home or something like that?
I set myself up for 12:30 every day with a ringtone. So ringtone is come home. But it's Thich Nhat Hanh told me to practice that.
Yes.
So it's sort of an interesting thing what you said, that we actually can begin to redirect our conditional response.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, that's what practice is really planting the intention to be not forgetful. Right? We're planting the intention to be not forgetful. And even though we can't make it happen, every time we have the opportunity, we keep planting the seed. It eventually has an effect. You know, we do decondition or weaken the habits, and we create or condition a different habit. You know, more awareness or more wakefulness in this case. Or a different response to, or a different reaction to the stimulus of the sound.
Last night, there was some conversation around self-pity, and you talked about when it came up for you, and you recognized it. You just recognized it every time. Is that all it takes to decondition it?
So last night, for those of you who weren't here, for those of you who were here, you can just take a nap. I was talking about, at some point when I was in Burma practicing, recognizing the voice of self-pity. The voice that said, oh poor me, blah, 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 blah. And that once I saw it, I was amazed that I'd never seen it before. But then once I saw it, I realized, oh, I got caught in that kind of mental state quite frequently in the past, but just didn't recognize it. And once I then saw it or recognized it, then I started noticing it all the time, or as often as it was happening, I would notice it. And in time, it stopped. I don't see it. I don't see it anymore. It doesn't arise. And the question is just seeing it what makes it stop, right? No. It's understanding it. Seeing, being mindful doesn't stop things from happening. It's how we understand it, because we can be mindful and still understand things wrongly. Okay? That's kind of a... I'm going to be a little bit careful about that. In a moment of mindfulness, you're understanding things correctly. But delusion is of two kinds. There's the delusion of not knowing, like, I didn't know self-pity. Didn't know. Totally ignorant of it. Didn't know it. And then when it arose, there was some wrong understanding of it. I saw it, but I understood it wrongly. It was only after I spent time with it, enough time with it, to understand, oh, this is the nature of self-pity. This is what it does. And remember last night I was saying, this is what self-pity does. Clunk. You collapse. You collapse into it. And this is what samadhi does. Self-pity arises and samadhi goes, that's me. Get absorbed. Slump. Mindfulness or awareness goes, self-pity, being known, self-pity is being known, and there's not the identification with it as I'm self-pitying. There's whoop, there's the awareness. So when I say samadhi enters into and vipassana pulls back from, that's what I mean. When you're practicing samadhi practice, if self-pity comes up, you get absorbed in it. If you're practicing vipassana and self-pity comes up, you go, whoa, oh, I get it. And you begin to understand it. You begin to understand how it arises, what it does to the mind, what kind of thoughts you have because of it, what it conditions in the body for sensations, how long it lasts, how it leaves the mind. When you understand this, then you kind of, it's not like you anticipate, but you see the conditions of your life unfolding in a certain way. And when self-pity is going to be, or could be, a reaction to something, you see it before it ever happens. You don't go there anymore. When something arises that would normally have given, or have conditioned a self-pitying response or reaction, you don't go there. You see those conditions before they give rise to self-pity.
My question was just, is there a way to really know it while you're being mindful of it? Because when I think of absorbing into something, it's about sort of feeling it physically. And is there a way to sort of really understand that, sort of take that texture while being apart from it?
So the question is, to really feel something, you kind of go into it and you feel it. Is it possible to feel it and be aware of it at the same time? That's what you're saying, right? Is it?
Well, I think...
Somebody's shaking their head. Yeah, sure. Is it? Yeah? You can do that? So it's a balance between subjective and objective. There's a feeling it subjectively and an awareness of it objectively. Okay? What do you think? What do you think? Does that sound reasonable? Is that your experience?
I wonder if they can exist simultaneously.
This is a three-dimensional instruction now, a visual instruction. What do you see? A bell ringer thing. What else do you see?
Black stick.
Black stick. What else do you see?
Stick.
Huh?
Hand.
Hand. No, 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 no. This thing. The thing in the hand. What do you see? So there's a bell ringer stick, black stick.
Brown spray.
Huh?
Shape.
I. Go ahead. One at a time.
Blackness.
Blackness.
Shape.
Shape. Huh? Hardness. No, I feel hardness. You don't feel hardness.
It's straight. It's a straight line.
Straight. Okay. What else?
Round.
Round. Yeah, if you look at it that way. Round. Anything else?
Size.
Huh?
Size.
Size. You see it's size. Small, we'll say. And the light off it. Okay. Now, we've had a lot of, you know, we've had a dozen different things being observed here. Right? Which one's right?
They're all right.
They're all right. None of them are wrong. But there's really only one thing here. So, Jhana, is there one thing or a dozen things here?
One thing.
One thing. Of which you can know a dozen things. Right? Okay. So now you have just answered your own question. Is it possible to experience something, to feel it, and to be aware of it at the same time? You can do, your mind can do two things at once, right? Just like it can recognize the shape and the color at the same time. In fact, you can't recognize the shape without the color. If there's no color here, you don't know the shape of this thing. Right? If there's no shape, you wouldn't know the color of it. Right? Okay, so is that the same thing as we were talking about the kind of the balance between subjective and objective, where you feel something subjectively and you know it objectively at the same time? Can you do that?
I think so. I think I tend to get like I absorb into it and get lost in it.
This is a good observation. This is the problem. This is the problem. We do. Actually, when we let our attention absorb into something in order to feel it more intimately, more carefully, more sensitively, more contact-wise, huh? We often leave, or the Vedana becomes strong and the perception becomes weak. When perception becomes weak, soon we're not going to recognize what we're feeling. We're lost in the feeling. Right? That's samadhi. Samadhi doesn't thrive on a clear perception of the unique characteristic, the uniqueness of that particular experience. So that in order to practice vipassana, are you with me? Are you losing? At least some of you. Okay. Vipassana requires that you sustain the clarity of your perception of what it is you're feeling. Because if you get absorbed in the feeling, you just go to sleep. You just get lost in it. You know, you don't perceive it. You just enter this tranquil state of pleasant feeling without knowing and clearly recognizing, oh, pleasantness is being known. Vipassana goes, okay, pleasantness, this is it, being known. It's right there, it's with it. It's feeling the pleasantness and it's knowing that pleasantness is being known.
I think there's another... If I run into another issue with that...
You run into another issue with that?
An unpleasant feeling.
Yes.
Being able to observe it, but then getting sucked into wanting it to go away.
Okay, so when an unpleasant feeling, physical or emotional, arises, and you're aware of it, you get sucked into the aversion. Okay, now I need to borrow a hand here because this is a three-dimensional visual instruction that needs three hands. Here's the unpleasantness, right? Here's the awareness, right? Awareness of unpleasantness. So unpleasantness is being known, right? But there is a filter right here between the awareness and the unpleasantness called aversion. Aversion. Your seeing or awareness is seeing the unpleasantness through the lens of aversion. Right? Okay? Now, the trick with vipassana is the filter of aversion becomes the new object. Okay? So, right, now this other unpleasantness, no longer the object. You're no longer in the present moment, frankly. Now you're into aversion being known. Vipassana would say the being known is what you want to work on. Whether it's unpleasantness or aversion, doesn't matter. It can be unpleasantness, it can be the breath, it can be sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, sensations, pleasant, unpleasant, gross, subtle, familiar, novel, it doesn't matter. What's important is this. And if there's a filter of one of the defilements that is distorting your perception of the object, then that becomes a new object. Right? Did you get it?
Mm-hmm.
Clear as hands, huh?
When you talked about your example of self-pity, it did seem as though you talked about not being deluded through gaining knowledge of that self-pity. And isn't samadhi the way you keep getting that knowledge, by really experiencing that self-pity so you know it? And then, or how did you know the feeling of being collapsed if you
didn't
come into that feeling?
How did I learn about self-pity without...
Without going into it, as she's saying,
Going into it, but keeping my perception really strong. Because if the perception weakens, you get absorbed in the experience. You know, the self-pity, the collapse, the kind of lily. But if the perception that is the voice of recognition, I see what's going on. There's this feeling, I know it. There's this knowing of it. If the knowing weakens, it's like this. you know, self-pity, being known. Self-pity, being known. Self-pity, being known. That's like getting pretty close to absorbing it. What Vipassana practice is going to ask you to do is self-pity, being known. Self-pity, being known. Self-pity, being known. You're still in touch with this self-pity, but you're emphasizing or you're strengthening the knowing, awareness part of the mind, or the mind, that activity of the moment. So we want to be careful not to get absorbed in the object, but rather to strengthen the clarity of the awareness and acknowledge that. So when you get too absorbed in this, you lose the awareness. If you are kind of like a scientist staring at something, this becomes so strong that you obliterate this. That's trying too hard. That's called striving. Striving. You're trying so hard, just like, and you don't really feel anything. You're just in your head. Oh, that's self-pity. But no actual feeling of the self-pity at the time that occurs. Yeah?
Maybe it would be useful to define what you mean by right samadhi. Like, because I think it's a little confusing to me to equate samadhi, just right samadhi, just with absorption. And and maybe you want to do it in the afternoon more, yep. But about kind of keeping Vipassana and Samadhi as two distinct sure. approaches, as opposed yep. to understanding the importance of Samadhi and Vipassana practice.
Yeah. So I will talk about Samadhi this afternoon. It's one of the tranquilizing, and we'll do that. But remind me, in case I don't make a clear distinction of what Vipassana Samadhi, how Vipassana Samadhi is different and similar to Samatha Samadhi. Okay. There's Vipassana Samadhi and there's Samatha Samadhi. Now, you know, in the Buddha's actual sutras, he does not distinguish between Samatha and Vipassana. He mentions the two, but he doesn't say this practice is for developing that and this practice is for developing that. It's only in commentaries after the Buddha where they really made the distinction between these are Samatha practices and these are Vipassana practices, exclusive. That's why Bhante Ji, for example, he says, you know, they're both happening all the time. Right? Even though you can enter Samatha Samadhi, jhanas, or in the Vipassana tradition of Mahasi out of Burma, we talk about the Vipassana jhanas. They're not really jhanas in a Samatha sense. Don't glaze over on me. But they're the equivalent stability of mind. I'm going to talk about samadhi in terms of stability of mind this afternoon. Did somebody else have a question over here? I was notified at the break that my panoramic vision has a weak peripheral brightness. It was kind of a little weak in picking up activity over here. So I just I gotta reorient the center of my panoramic vision to about here.
I'm trying to put together, I know that you and many other teachers have said the mind can only pay attention to one thing at a time, and the thing might come really, really fast, so the mind might oscillate from thing to thing. I'm sort of trying to put that together with this idea of the panoramic vision, and on the break, in conversation with another yogi, who said, this is why it's against the law to text and drive. Because we're not very good at fully paying attention at texting and driving, and the consequences are lethal. And so that kind of brings me back to my hunch, you know, that for me, if there's too much going on here, my attention can't keep up with it. And so, again, I sort of way I'm asking for clarification between these two.
So the question is, can you pay attention to more than one thing at a time? There's a couple different ways to answer that question. One is, the texts say blah, 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 blah. But your experience may say something else. So we have to kind of understand what it is we're actually looking for. Are we looking for the authoritative answer, or are we looking at a way of understanding our experience? The second one. Okay, so if we're looking at a way to understand our experience, then if you look in the night sky and you can see the moon, the full moon, and you can see the stars surrounding it at the same time, then it's clear. Your understanding says you can be aware of more than one thing at a time. Right? So, if that's the way you understand things, then you should really know, this is what I see and can confirm from my own experience. And hold that lightly, because with increased power of mind, concentration, and increased clarity of perception, sanya, perception, and momentum of awareness, you may have a different understanding. So we don't want to lock into an understanding prematurely when our mind is at one level, say, of samadhi and wisdom. But it is important to know what you have confirmed from, or what you believe, based on your own experience, your own empirical experience. And the books would say, whatever the books say, but the books saying what they say, it may be important to read that and to know that, but it's more important to know what your own experience is. Did I evade answering that question? Okay.
I've got a similar question. I'm the one that asked James
McCoy. You're just going to have to speak up. Yeah.
But it's similar. In Upandita saying, act like an old sick person when you practice. And you're saying the teaching answers, go as fast as you want. If you're, you know, if your mindfulness is there, you'll hit it all. But the question is, you know, is it, well, what serves your mindfulness better, I suppose, and go toward...
What serves your mindfulness better?
You know, you could, I mean, if you do you make a choice, you know, say, in like, I have a thing of walking meditation, sure, should I walk fast, should I walk slow? You know, is that the answer? Whatever serves your mindfulness, go that speed? Or, like in life, you don't have a choice, do you... choose to slow down your life? Or you're saying, doesn't matter, go as fast as you want. You can be mindful of both.
What's your experience, Joanne?
I have had deeper experiences of concentration when I go slow.
Fine.
But I've never tried the other way.
I like the way you put that. I've had deeper experiences of concentration when I go slow. I would agree with that. Yeah. And concentration is samadhi. Samatha. Tranquility. Tranquility of mind, tranquility of body as a result of mind. But it isn't insight, and it isn't understanding. So, I mean, if you want to develop samadhi and tranquility, then you're saying you find that going slow is most effective. Anybody want to agree or disagree with that? Agree?
Yes.
Disagree? Okay. So, now Vipassana. How are you going to gain understanding about the nature of walking? How are you going to gain understanding about the nature of the body and the mind in the walking process? Do you have to walk slow? Can you walk fast and pay attention and learn about it?
Well, I was originally told to walk slow, so it's kind of a new thing. You can walk fast if you want. I sort of understood it that way. So I'm very open to the opposite.
You'll have to try it. If you try it, then you'll know, right?
And I've tried a bit, and it's pretty good.
Yeah.
And I love the freedom of it.
Yeah. Okay.
I love the freedom.
Okay. Mark?
Well, I'm wondering if part of the questions that people are asking have to do, like, I mean, it's about continuity of attention regardless, right? So then it's a question, what's the object? And it may be what you're really pointing to. Maybe you could talk more about it, Steve, like how the mind chooses its object. I mean, you did a little bit, but it might be good to maybe make it more explicit. Because when you slow down in walking, you know, it allows you to have continuity with a particular object, like all the intricate movements of the leg and feet.
For example, yeah.
But when you're walking fast, you still need continuity of mindfulness, but it's a different object, so you're not required to go slowly with that object.
Yeah. That's true. So what Mark is talking about is the continuity of awareness, or the continuity of mindfulness, right? And if the attention, awareness, or mindfulness takes a recurring object like sensations of the breath or sensations of walking as its object, the subjective feeling is one of great tranquility. That's the subjective feeling. But the continuity of the awareness, the continuity of the mindfulness, is what we're really working on. If the objects are changing in every moment, for example, from a sight to a sound to a thought to a sensation to a blah, 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 but the continuity is at the same rate as a single object, what's going on there? Which is which? We would say that if you have a same object, like the breath or some sensations in a narrow range of the foot or the belly, and you recurringly attend to that with a frequency like this, you'll have one kind of experience. If the same frequency of awareness is happening, but the objects are a sensation, a thought, a sound, a this, a that, a memory, a plan, a this, a da, 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 then you'll have a different experience. Right? The first leads to samadhi, or tranquility, deep tranquility, calmness, and the second leads to understanding, wisdom.
So you're saying the second is better?
That's your spin. No, I'm saying that it leads to a different knowledge. Because the knowledge of samadhi, the knowledge of jhana, is very important. And the Buddha has praised people who practice that kind of practice. You know, in the knowledge of the mind that comes from developing that level of absorption and tranquility is really significant. It's an exalted state of mind it's not easy to reach. It's not easy to have that knowledge of the mind, the capacity of the mind. And when you practice the vipassana, and the knowledge that you gain from that is different than samadhi knowledge. It's the knowledge of the impermanence of things. It's the knowledge of the dukkha characteristic of things. It's the knowledge of the impersonal or the anatta, essenceless nature of things. That's a different kind of knowledge. It has different consequences. Yeah, they're both good.
Are you acknowledged?
Yeah.
Don't you need a certain modicum of samadhi in order to do the practice?
Do you need a certain minimum, modicum, she said, minimum, of samadhi to do vipassana practice? Anybody want to weigh in on that?
It helps a lot because I think otherwise, I at least am sort of a scattered mind, and so sometimes doing vipassana when I'm not sure what my object is or it's always changing. Well, so then my experience of it always changing is that I don't know. I'm getting confused.
Okay, I want to diagram what you just said.
Okay.
So. Okay. Now it's not just this object; it's all five of them. There's a lot of things being known, right? And you're saying, I get confused. Right? Confusion is this filter right here. If you recognize the confusion, no problem. This is going on, flurry, flurry, scurry, scurry, but confusion. That's what you see. If you heighten if you expand the catalog or the list of things you recognize, because you recognize, you told me about it, you said, I feel confused. But you didn't, you weren't aware of it. You were still trying to be aware of these things.
Yeah.
And you were missing the obvious thing. The most obvious thing was the confusion. Right? Missed it. I told her, you know, last night, I lived with self-pity for a long time. Never recognized it. Just like you live with confusion. Don't recognize it. How are we going to recognize this which we've been living with for so long and see it for the first time? This is the challenge of Vipassana practice. How are we going to see the obvious that we've overlooked for so long? So, this over here, don't worry about this over here. Catch this here. Recognize this. What was the question? I don't think we can answer that definitively, because what I'm trying to point to is the misunderstanding. I think there's a pretty prevalent misunderstanding about the nature of samadhi and the nature of insight. So I don't want to answer it from the point of view of the question. But this afternoon we're going to talk more about samadhi, and especially Vipassana samadhi. Yeah, and then you'll have more input answer to answer your question. Yeah.
Your free-handed demonstration is really helpful. I just saying what came up in my mind, and the also piece of the catalog of the object is, I mean, that's really helpful. I think I really was really stuck in the mural.
Yeah.
And I had a big fight with my son last night, and I noted, and I went right in the middle of it, you know. I thought, here, you know, knows what's going on. But what I didn't, and I know it's anger, but what I didn't see was that filter of my own attachment, my own identification with my anger, which really kept it going. You know, rather than, and that's a bad thing, I shouldn't feel it, and I didn't, you know, I wasn't accepting.
You mean the self-righteousness. I'm angry, I should be angry. They're doing
and
something.
I hung on. Because I thought I was acting like a child. I am not. But I was. But anyway, seeing that, having that, you know, just being able to be more exact about what it is that's happening. You know,
this is really, I mean, this is the task of Vipassana practice, is to see the obvious that hasn't yet been recognized. It really is a challenge. Because you don't know what you're looking for. You know, if you keep looking at what you know, you don't give an opportunity for what you don't yet know to appear. It's mine.
Well, I've been working with a lot of chronic pain.
Chronic pain?
Yeah, and I found that going at it with samadhi, going into it,
Yes.
Then helped me to see the filter of aversion, because once I could get into the pain fully, deeply, the fear of it was that I was able to let go of it, because I realized, oh, okay, do you know what I mean?
Sure.
But once you can really get into it,
yes,
then the fear is you can overcome the fear, and then you can see the filter of aversion.
Sure.
So because I used samadhi and went into it deeply,
yes,
I was able to come out of it with a broader view now of the whole disorder, mm-hmm, and no longer have that filter of aversion that would make me pinpoint each pain and each fear now, and then of course then that would go into this shut down mode of I won't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now I kind of step back, so now because of my injury, now I'm in this,
mm-hmm,
this whole thing, and okay, this is just this, and this is what needs to be done to deal with this. So how do you know, to me it seems like they work together.
What do you mean when you say you go into it? What actually happens? You know, you've got this pain, And then you say you go into it with samadhi, but
I allow myself to feel it deeply. I mean, to completely feel it deeply with no aversion.
With no aversion.
No aversion.
That's right. That's the key. Because what I heard you say is there's this pain, and there is some kind of like, I hate it, I don't like it, I want to get rid of it.
At the beginning.
Yeah. But then you said you let your awareness go in to actually feel that without aversion. That's mindfulness. That's mindfulness. That's not just samadhi. There's wisdom there because you're feeling the nature, the unique nature of that pain, right? Without any hindrance in the mind. That's vipassana. Yeah. And then when you see that, you know, if there's any attempt at the mind to spin an aversive story about it, you see it, it doesn't happen. Why? Because the wisdom factor is too strong to let that defilement in. So you're just with, and this is what the mindfulness is. Mindfulness is the not floating away, not wobbling, and it's guarding the mind, meaning you're confronting the object and you're not letting in the defilements. So you're actually going right into, and because of it, you can have this strong, strong perception. You have a very clear perception of the very nature of that sensation, right? It's aching, it's hardness, it's flickering, heat, it's what, you know, just the real... That's good insight. That's good insight practice. It's also good. It's good stability of mind. It's
so
good samadhi.
So that isn't samadhi?
No, that's samadhi. That's vipassana samadhi.
Oh, okay.
That's vipassana samadhi because you're noticing. you're noticing the quality of the pain. If you weren't noticing the quality of those flickering sensations, then you could just be in samatha samadhi. Samatha samadhi doesn't recognize the unique characteristic of those sensations. But vipassana samadhi does. You laugh. Why?
Always tell the types of samadhi I'm sitting here trying to
apart. The samadhi is in the continuity of awareness, as Mark mentioned.
That's the nature
of samadhi. The depth of samadhi or the degree of samadhi or the strength of samadhi is dependent on the continuity of awareness. Now, what the object is of your awareness will determine whether it is a vipassana samadhi or a samatha samadhi. If you're observing the unique flavor called the sabhava, the unique flavor of that momentary experience, then you'll develop vipassana. If you're observing the kind of the conceptual general experience or knowledge of that experience, then you'll go into samatha. Samatha samadhi.
What would be an example of that? The
latter. Samatha samadhi.
Yes.
Okay. When we breathe in through the nostrils, because this is called anapanasati, huh? We're paying attention to the breath at the nostrils. If you're feeling the actual experiential texture of each sensation as you breathe in and out, you'll develop vipassana. But if you just have a sense of breathing in, breathing out, breathing in, breathing out, you conceptually know when you're breathing in and it's accurate, and when you're breathing out and it's accurate, but you're not feeling the actual momentary textures of it, then you'll develop samatha samadhi. Samatha samadhi is stability of mind on what we would say is an unchanging object, the knowledge or the concept of the breath. But vipassana samadhi arises on the same degree or same continuity of awareness of changing objects, like tingling, pressure, heat, cold, you know, sensations like that. Yeah.
That description of samatha samadhi doesn't sound like an absorption practice. That sounded like a disconnect in the way that you described that, like a conceptual idea of in and out. Or
all the jhanas or all the absorptions take as an object a concept. They take as a concept.
Okay.
They're all concepts. You know, loving kindness is a when you conceive of a person, it's a concept. Vipassana would say there's no person there. So you take the person and you develop the loving kindness to for second, third jhana, whatever it is. All samatha, all concentration, tranquility practices have as their object a concept.
So sort of global and specific, or forests and trees?
Say it again?
I'm sorry. Sort of the forest and the trees, is it more like that? Sort of a global...
Okay, I'm going to give you a lesson in concepts and reality. Okay? Because that's what we're talking about. The concept of something and the reality of something. Hold your hand up like this. Everybody, this is called holding your hand out in front of you. Right? That's the concept. So, we're holding our hand out in front of you. Just know you're holding your hand out in front of you. Just keep knowing it. You're holding your hand out in front of you. Holding your hand out in front of you. Just keep knowing that. So don't feel it. Just know that you're holding your hand out in front of you. Right? Don't feel it. Just hold your hand out in front of you. And keep knowing that. There are people that develop the ability to do this for days on end. You know, there are some of those practitioners in India. They'll stand on one leg for hours, days. You know, because they're not really experiencing it. They just have the idea in their mind. Oh, and they get absorbed in that idea. You can hold your hand out there forever because you're absorbed in the idea. But Vipassana would say, okay, this is called holding your hand out in front of you. Hey. Now, what's that feel like? What's the actual experience? What do you actually feel? I feel some aching here. Some coolness here, some tingling here, a little shaking there, a little vibrating there, right? When you get really into that experience of shaking, aching, hardness, tightness, pressure, shrinking, throbbing, bumping, bum, 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 you forget holding arm in front. Gone. Ceases to exist. There's no time, there's no arm, there's no hand, there's no in front, there's no back, there's no space, there's nothing. There's just throbbing, pulsing, vibrating, tingling, tightening, right? That's Vipassana. That will lead to wisdom about the nature of holding your hand. But hold, okay. That's the difference. Vipassana has to be experiencing things at that level. Samatha has to be experiencing things at the concept level.
About the positive practice, because sometimes I find that it makes me feel disoriented instead of bringing my mind together.
Good.
Like things are falling apart.
That's right. That makes you feel, the Vipassana practice makes you feel disoriented.
Yeah.
Why?
Because I start to connect with just the sensations, just the feelings.
Sure.
And then it sort of, things start to break apart.
Sure, that's right. Because what happens at a certain level of Vipassana practice, it takes a while, but as you pay attention to all the sensations in the body in an ongoing way, and you pay attention to all the mental stuff that's in an ongoing way, you stop putting it together into a concept of me sitting like this, having this kind of experience. And all that activity of the mind that makes the concept, conceptual understanding of it, fades away into the background. And your mindfulness is just with the immediacy of experience. So you don't know whether you've got a body, what size it is, what shape it is. You don't know that. You don't. The mind doesn't have time to process things into that conceptual knowledge. And so you just have experiences of body and mind happening somewhere in vast empty space. No wonder it's disorienting, right? And so when you think, you know, sometimes you're sitting, everybody's had this experience. You're sitting, and you think, I wonder where my hands are. You know, it's like, I wonder where my hands are. It's like, God, I can't feel them even. You know, I feel some sensations, but I can't tell if they're like this or like that, or are they touching each other, or the thumbs are, I don't know. Can't tell, right? If you open your eyes and look, or if you move your hands in order to do it, then you come back into conceptual reality. Boom. You're no longer in Vipassana reality. You're no longer in the absolute experiential reality. You've kind of broken the spell, so to speak, or you've come back under the spell of concept. So Vipassana practice says, when you have that kind of experience and you lose your body size, shape, form, location, don't open your eyes, don't move your body. Keep going. Yeah, take it apart. Take apart those concepts so that you can really get comfortable and live with the live within the reality of experience rather than the reality of concept. This is the difference between relative and absolute reality, the views of reality. The relative view of reality is body, mind, the size, the shape, this location. Experientially, it's gone. It's just stuff. Right? Happy.
What about the
concept of hunger? Even looking at your watch? Okay, I thought you might just be conceptually hungry, like, oh, it's quarter to one, time to eat. But if you're really feeling the sensations of discomfort in the belly, then that's insight. You've had the profound insight. Hunger has arisen. Oh yeah, we've been jabbering on for a while. Why don't we take a break? One last comment.
So in your understanding of self-pity, you use both types of
samatha,
of the sexual and of the more physical sensations.
Sure.
I
was practicing Vipassana.
Right.
And so I saw not only the physical, you know, collapsing energy of this mind state, but I recognized the mind state of self-pity, you know, and its feeling, how that felt. And then the story about it. And then there was the, the reflective experience of like, oh, I remember this feeling from many times in the past, but I never saw it, never recognized it. So really, it's practicing insight because it was all pixelated. But when I attributed it to a me in the past that was experiencing it, that's samatha. That's more conceptual. Yeah, not direct experience, it's remembering. Right? Yeah. But in the moment of recognizing, it was direct, right then. Right that moment. And then I say, oh, now that I see this, I've seen this a lot. Okay. Anybody fall asleep yet? No. Okay. That's good. Anybody over there fall asleep? Okay. So we'll take an hour. It's 10 of 1. We'll be back at 10 of 2. Be sure to eat a Vipassana meal, not a Samatha meal. So it's just a full nourishment.